All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our next panel session. I'm Guy Finley. I'm not only the host of the stage all day, but I'm honored to be moderating this session with these great individuals. We're talking about safeguarding against broadcast signal and OTT intrusions. Okay, this really, when you talk about what was the onus for us to have the cybersecurity pavilion with NAB and why did they approach us, it was basically around this, right? This is the core session for this pavilion, in a sense that we're all broadcasters, we're all looking at new forms of delivery, and we're all suffering, I think as we'll learn, from intrusion attempts in the cybersecurity space. So this great panel of experts is here to talk about this. I won't introduce you each, but I'll start with Tim down on the end. If you'll introduce yourself, tell us your title, and tell us what you do, where you work.
Hey, I'm Tim Davis. I'm the VP of Product at iStream Planet, and we build basically media processing with OTT solutions, everything from transcoding, security, and just that.
Fantastic, Pete.
I'm Pete Cronus. I'm the CISO at Turner. Information security, content security, business continuity, compliance, all fall within my purview.
Fantastic.
Hi, I'm Andrew Howard. I'm the Chief Technology Officer with the Fidelity Group. Our brands provide from NAGRA to end-to-end content protection, to anti-piracy, to watermarking content. My job is cybersecurity, specifically around broadcast systems, as well as enterprise security.
Fantastic, thank you, gentlemen. And by the way, if you have a question while we're going, go ahead and shoot up your hand. I have the only wireless microphone, so we'll be passing it to you in a football style, and you get extra points if you get it. And by the way, we do have seats too. If you're standing room only and you want to come in and sit down, please join us.
Please don't rush the stage.
Yeah, don't touch the talent. All right, so let's start with a little bit of the synopsis of the session itself. The first sentence is, how can companies detect intrusion attempts and prevent similar disruptions and also defend against other immediate attacks such as DDoS? So when we talk about these types of attacks, are you seeing and through the course of the day, are you exposed to these threats? Is this something that you're seeing growing in regularity, in frequency, and intensity? I'm just trying to establish the base here and not say this is a bunch of hullabaloo.
Yeah, from our standpoint, we certainly see it effectively we're under constant attack. We have a lot of end user facing endpoints, and it's just the reality it's 24/7, so it's not so much as when, but it's kind of how we manage it all the time.
Constant, persistent.
Yeah, I'd say that the intensity has increased substantially in terms of the volumetric style attacks, the DDoS attacks, right? And then we're seeing, certainly an increase in sophistication. So you think about Turner and the brands in Turner, think CNN, right? And so we're seeing a lot of nation state type activity, sent to us. And, it could be as simple as a phishing email, right? Which is the most consistent way companies or groups starts out with an email to an unsuspecting user. That's what we see most often. We're also seeing huge numbers of probes against infrastructure, public-facing infrastructure on the network as well. So we see it kind of from the inside out and the outside in.
I can let you jump in, but hold on. We're really talking also, it's broad in a sense because, a phishing attack could be an attempt to get a PII. But you're also looking at things like hijacks, right? It's the thing that happened with RT a couple months ago, right? I mean, this isn't something where, can you expand a little bit around some of the scope and scale of the things you said without obviously giving any messages?
Yeah, I mean, if you took a look at the TV5 Mond attack, right, many believe that started with phishing email, right? And, for those of you who are familiar with the attack, nation state sponsored attack, took out the entire broadcasting digital infrastructure for that particular French broadcaster. Some believe it was a proof of concept attack, right? They all started with a very simplistic set of phishing messages sent to unsuspecting employees. The network was flat, so it wasn't very well segmented, so it was very easy, relatively easy, I should say, for the attackers to move around in the network and get to key and critical infrastructure and take them down.
And I think I agree with the comments from before, but I'll say that the major theme that we see on the content protection side is more and more and more. We've been defending these types of systems for 25 years, traditionally they were air gapped, or what we call sneaker netted. So you'd have to, would be physically disconnected from the internet. And there were still threats, and they were still actively attacked. But now these systems are connected. And so as soon as that wire was connected into the broadcast systems, all the threats that exist on the enterprise security side that used to impact these networks, but not to really the same level, now fully impact these networks. And so all these attacks that Pete just described persist and are now in the risk portfolio of the broadcast systems. And therefore, we got to start thinking about new defense mechanisms and new mitigations. What was interesting to me about the TV5 attack specifically is that they were targeted, A, so this just wasn't some fly-by-night, let's just go take them down, it'll be fun, kids drinking Mountain Dew, eating pizza in the basement kind of thing. That isn't them. And the second thing is that they were there for a long time. So this just wasn't like, hey, it's Friday, let's take them down by 5 p.m., there's an issue. They've been there for weeks, if not months. And that requires real mitigations and real professionals to go after those kinds of attacks.
Now, I think there's another interesting thing that Andrew just mentioned about the air gaps. The other trend that we see is pretty material is most of us are running very complicated workflows for content protection across vendors, in public cloud, across private networks, which is quite different. So the number of times we cross a security domain to actually get a workflow done, I think, is a whole new challenge for us as a vendor community. And there's clearly no standardization protocol, just agency handling. Customers are all over the map of what they actually expect from the central, both their private and their cloud vendors. And that is a major challenge for us across different systems and actually how to audit it, track it, and actually maintain an effective team. So I think there's some things we haven't had to deal with the content side.
I've worked all across a lot of different verticals, and from oil and gas to government to finance, and this space is way behind other spaces. From other verticals, from a cybersecurity space. In fact, it feels a lot like industrial control systems and oil and gas systems that were never connected, now they are, and now they're 10 times more complicated than they were 10 years ago. So the security ramifications are just now 100x because of how much more complicated they are. So there's a lot of work to do and a lot of catch up to happen.
I think that's a rapidity question too, right? When you're streaming toward broadcasting IP, right, or streaming to get into the cloud, sometimes it's like, save fast or cheap, right? Which one do you lose? I mean, is this something also from a budgetary perspective, right? And from the money that you're allocated to do it, sometimes people just throw money at it, right? There's just classes in business. But being smart, I mean, how have you seen that rapid embrace? And I'm not talking also just you being a content creator, but also your trusted partners and the vendors that you work with.
Yeah, let's start with the vendor because I think Tim really nailed something. It's interesting, we're going in and talking to vendors who've also talked to other kind of content creators before us. And we might be talking to them for the first time and we say, well, what types of security controls do you have in place? What have other vendors asked you to do? And, we really have to step up our game because very often we're hearing from these vendors that nobody's really asked them anything. They filled out a form, they send it in, and that was the last I heard of it. So really, if we want to be, I know there's a focus and emphasis on building some standards, which are sorely needed. So that's the answer to, I think, your second question. If I go back to the first one, I think as security professionals, the media industry is looking at us to set a series of priorities, right? Because you can't, many of these companies have been around 20, 30, in Turner's case, 40 years, and information security really wasn't a priority. And so they're looking for us information security leaders to come in and establish a set of, tell them what good looks like, what their focus and priorities are. And again, we're in the risk reduction business, we're not in the risk elimination business. So there always be some risk. The question is, what's the right risk to take on behalf of the business?
I'd also say that probably goes hand in hand with the evolution of technologies, right? I mean, how have you seen your individual technology stacks evolve? And I would also say, caveat that question with, now you work with trusted partners, right? I mean, talk to me a bit about that evolution. I would say also, gentlemen, I know, when you're product-based, you're always evolving, right? You're always thinking up the next version of your best products, right?
Well, our industry's in disruption right now, right? So not only are you trying to evolve the product, but you're trying to do it at rapid pace, right? Because there's really billions of dollars in the line, right? So So I think there's a sense in terms of evolving the technology stack to meet that that disruption is heading at a lightning speed, you know. And so I think just trying to be a part, be at the table when those technology decisions are made are key and critical.
I think something that came to mind is about that classic trade-off. I don't see in the market right now, it's actually not cost-constrained. I think it's like capability-constrained. I think people will understand security, but the vendors, the infrastructure, and the connection points just simply don't work. And I think people are making a trade-off with as well. Do I stop and install my business and it's up to time, or do I accept that higher risk? So that's my personal observation to think our customers is not that they're unaware of security, they just can't get it done unless they're in the price.
I think it'd be easy to say we just need more money, we just need more technology, that'll solve the problem. Certainly working for a security vendor that's in favor of more money. But I really think the answer is just take advantage of the tried and true principles that have been around forever. This security problem is difficult, but the principles that we're applying have been around for a long time. It's just doing it correctly. Strong governance, strong audit controls, strong policy, strong technology. And I'll finally say this is a business driven by availability. And that is very antithetical to security, more so than other industries like banking, where you're also concerned about integrity, but here availability is everything.
I was also going to pick on Tim, you know, because you're like, this is something also that when you talk about broadcast over IP, when you talk about OTT, right? Those things go very much hand in hand. It's essentially an IP delivery mechanism. It's just, what do you see in terms of the transmutation of your business, especially over the last 5 years, and going from a fringe app base, nice to have, to a technical need to have? And what's the security implications around that? And basically saying everybody now has an OTT.
Yeah, so it's a fantastic point. One of the big things that is OTT goes from kind of an adjacent kind of science project, if you will, to mainstream media. One is premium content's coming there, so the value is much, much higher. So where people are putting their sort of evergreen content, the things about security are much, much higher. And compared to, I would say, classic broadcast over IP, which were on closed networks and to, you know, basically very secure devices, the diversity of devices and endpoints is much, much higher with completely different varying degrees of security. And back to the business priority, no one really wants to cut off a number of their users, and actually says the platform's not secure. So it's that trade-off of open ecosystem, widely varying security standards across mobile devices and modern and set-top boxes and connected devices, some of which are fantastic security, some of which have virtually all software-based security. And it's a very complex trade-off. I don't think the stage for me actually had a vertically integrated broadcast IP stack 5 years ago.
I think the diversity point is clear and very important. As an example, in older broadcast days, pre-OTT, we put out a lot of different technologies to protect content on the endpoint. Today, we have about 500 million devices in the field, but we were able to control everything about the endpoint to the point that we were working with the top 7 chip manufacturers to embed our intellectual property inside their chips, so we provide very hardened endpoints from a security perspective. Now OTT comes into the picture. There's no chance I'm going to go work with every chip manufacturer, for every chip variant, for every hardware variant, for every player variant. So this OTT thing from a vendor protection perspective really adds a lot of complexity, more so than just being connected to the internet. There's also content protection concerns.
Well, we always worked in a closed environment in the past, right? They never had any of these implications.
I agree with you. And I think what's interesting and changing and evolving is the ecosystem and delivering content over apps, right? And you think about the variety of different platforms that these guys alluded to, and application security and having strong application security practices for yourself and your partners is key and critical as well, right? So you're not putting your content at risk, you're not putting your customer data at risk as well. And so when you talk to some of the bigger players out there, folks who have, you know, kind of a global presence, footprint, application footprint, they're thinking that is the new kind of frontier for them in their security space. Like, how do you deal with put an application on a phone that's never will be patched, right? And all the security vulnerabilities that might come over the life of that phone, it's just not going to be addressed with that. So how do you harden that app? How do you protect your content? How do you protect your user? Those are challenges that some of the big kids haven't figured out, and it's going to be a challenge that as we bring these OTT apps and take them global, we're going to have to address as well.
Yeah, I think that also is another interesting thing. Is, you know, from a practical standpoint, I think what we're seeing folks also be able to look at is assessing risk based on statistics. So clearly none of this stuff is perfect, but what we're seeing is folks saying, okay, where am I leaking? What are distribution chains? What's the impact? And is it manageable? So we see that practically turns into interest in watermarking and basically monitoring and seeing where the content's going. And then assessing the business impact. I mean, clearly, if you're only leaking a little bit of content, may decide for a live event that's in a satisfactory piece versus if someone's wholesale harvesting your VOD content and basically reselling it or, you know, giving it away in a jurisdiction where you don't have good options, much different problem space. So that's what I'm seeing in the market is people looking at tracking and monitoring as kind of renewed interest in that versus trying to tighten the security boundary itself.
Well, isn't that interesting also because, you know, it doesn't matter which or where it is, right? But it's being attacked, whether it's your classic VOD, you know, old stuff that you're never going to sell again, right? Come hell or high water, right? I kind of look at it when it's all online, any of those threats are vulnerable. It all depends on what that system is connected to. So the more we grow our ecosystem, the more vulnerable these other pieces could potentially be. How do we get around something?
Well, I'll say one thing. I beg to differ. The content is always available for sale. We just launched an app with Warner Brothers and are featuring like Scooby-Doo and some of the classics. People are buying.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, so you just never know.
Well, price is right and the right availability, right?
And right.
I'm talking more about the traditional.
Of course.
Like, you're not going to go back and resell Beverly Hillbillies to Southeast Asian market. You can't.
You don't know that.
I like that. That's so optimistic. That is too optimistic. So the threat vectors and also your experience around all this stuff, the more we build out all these inventive ways to touch everyone, it also inherently creates holes, right?
Yeah,
that somebody can technically exploit.
It does, and it's another super interesting thing is, you know, this is clearly a time when the weakest link is clearly exploitable worldwide. So it's not just a regional vulnerability. We're seeing multi-language content distributed in Asia and in Europe and the U.S., and we'll see people actually be able to harvest that content across boundaries appropriately versus before we might say this is contained to a LATAM risk for us, and actually, you know, it's only in the Spanish language. But that content is so much more broadly distributed and so easily to access for people who are maliciously attacking it. I think that's another major change from like 5 years ago when the risk was both temporal and geographical. Now I think that risk is a single global risk pool for content protection.
I think, again, to make a comparison to another market, this is very much like threats they see in banking and other verticals. But I think the big difference here is that the availability, like I said before, the availability requirements are crazy high. And one question I get asked often is, are we ever going to get there? Like, are we ever going to be secure enough that we don't need all these security controls anymore? We don't need the investments? And my answer is, I think there's just so much to do, and the ecosystem is growing at such a rate that we've got to be concentrating on risk reduction, as you said before. And that seems to me that, kind of part of a point that you said earlier, that these formulas about how much is content worth over time, you know, I think about a graph with T on the x-axis, you know, how long over time is this content reduced in value, those are becoming very important because it's determining the controls that we go deploy and how rigorously we defend them.
You know, I'm interested also in, you know, obviously without any secrecy, right? I'm interested in the sophistication of some of the things that we've come across in terms of what you see within the course of your work. From a threat perspective, right, like you say a DDoS attack, and it's like, oh yeah, DDoS, right?
Yeah, look, the reality is yeah, no. Look, the reality is the attacks don't have to be incredibly sophisticated these days, right? Because we haven't figured out a way to close holes in software. And so even if we write the perfect app or the perfect streaming service and we put it out there, it's always going to be living on something that we didn't write, like an operating system that has holes in it. And all it takes is one person having one bad day, and you're introducing bugs. So I think, you know, again, attacks don't have to be like incredibly sophisticated to work. And that's why you have to have things like incident response. Okay, no matter how good your protection or protective controls are in place, you have to have somebody watching what's going on in your networks, what's going on in your apps, and responding quickly if they see something anomalous.
That's similar to what I was thinking also. That's where also watermarking comes into play.
I think watermarking is critical part of the process. And I talk to a lot of distributors that say our systems are very secure, we don't need watermarking, or we don't care. And my experience is that you always care. You want to know how your content's getting out, even if it's just for business intelligence purposes. You want to know where that content is and where it might be leaking, or where it might not be that you didn't want it. So that's a key part of the equation. I'll also say that I agree that I think that most attacks that we see are not that complicated, because they don't need to be. But on the other hand, I've seen attacks that are extreme, and they tend to be targeted. And I think this TV5 issue in France is a good example of that. When the attacker's motivated, the controls, whatever security crutches they put in place, probably don't matter. And that's a tough game to play. So we got to be, as security professionals, you're always playing this game of, I got to protect the system against the easy attacks, but I always got to be worried about these guys that are willing to take extreme measures. I've seen equipment brought into foreign nation-state labs. I've seen thousands of people hired online to take on certain tasks. I've seen millions of dollars spent. So they're not afraid to do that if they need to, but that far and away is not what most attacks look like. Far and away, they're the easy kind. Someone left their front door open.
But Andrew, I mean, quite a few times, which is super salient for my business, is the availability issue. What we're seeing is people putting more premium content, live content, especially sports entertainment experiences, and availability, that's a very vulnerable to denial of service attacks, and the value of that is minute by minute. So it's not like we can actually have a user restart the Super Bowl or some other premium event like March Madness. It's like when that thing is done, that ad on social media is gone forever. So the vulnerability is much, much higher on an availability basis than we would see in SVOD sort of thing. Terrible for a user, they can come back later, finish watching their program. But when live sports is on, it's all or nothing. So the risk reward there is very high from an attacker standpoint.
But I was going to say, it's interesting, because when you talk about broadcast signal intrusion versus OTT intrusion, I assume those are two very separate attack vectors with two very separate objectives.
They're
about to become one, right?
Right, yeah.
Right? And that's what I was saying, is can you contrast the past with, because ultimately, that's why I say, we'll all be OTT, right? I mean, by definition, OTT is broadcast on IP, right? See, essential thing. It just depends on where it is, where are you delivering it to. But, I mean, is this something that you see in,
Well, I have a lot of people who work for me who don't sleep much. No, of course. I think it's an interesting question. I think the data that I track in our scenarios is, I say news is the more vulnerable vector for attack. And back to what Pete said, we definitely see nation state-like attacks on news sources for fairly nefarious non-commercial purposes. For live sports, I think we see just more general issues. I haven't seen that spike up as much, but news is a highly vulnerable thing. And as news becomes as OTT-based news becomes a primary source of information for decision-making and command and control around the world, that's a super vulnerable place. And it's also a hard problem to fix.
Yeah, for CNN, I can tell you that we have to be, we're investing a lot in improving and enhancing security. We protect our fake news at the same rate that we protect our unfake news. So
you're doing a really, really great job.
Thank you. I think news is definitely the big vector for us and top risk. And they don't care how they get to the news. They can come and get to it from TNT, TBS if they, if they try, right? If we didn't have the type of segmentation we have, they could get at it from anywhere, right? We have news bureaus all over the world as well, including some very not friendly places. The other thing that's kind of interesting, and Tim knows this, is that when something bad happens, our companies are working to try to get employees out of those locations. Andy's with our business continuity team. He knows. We also try to send people in, right? So we're getting employees out. We're sending reporters in. And so that's incredibly dangerous as well. So we talk a lot about, you know, the importance of kind of securing the uplink of the broadcast signal, but we're also, a lot of these folks are in kind of harm's way as well. And I didn't really appreciate that as a news consumer until I joined Turner about a year and a half ago. It's a pretty dangerous business.
What do you do on the watermarking content identification side for live and for sports? I mean, obviously, you have systems that are real time, that are, you know, can you talk a little bit about that from that, detection?
Watermarking, we provide those services across VOD and live. The security requirements and the threats are different in both environments. On the VOD side, what we're concerned about is people stealing content and redistributing it, reselling it. On the live side, we're concerned about them offering it through a new stream, modifying it, or just flat out denying it. And we want to know where that content is going and where it has been. So watermarking is kind of key throughout that process. And it's more difficult on the live side, less time, it's got to be done on time. On the VOD side, it tends to be a process that you can execute, and you can execute it over and over and over and over again. On the live side, it's a much more difficult problem, and it's something that we're working. And it feeds right into the anti-piracy businesses that people like Turner and others run to mitigate those concerns.
You want to talk about MMA?
Sure. Anything different? Actually, before I get there, I just was also just kind of thinking about some interesting things that come into play. One is from an integrity standpoint. Again, broadcast IP chain, highly managed, create a closed network, run out to a satellite or an antenna, and broadcast out one to many. For our OTT feeds, where this is obviously internet basis for the end user, we have now 1,000 points of vulnerability. It's a much, much different situation that can protect all the classic enterprise IP attacks as well as the broadcast content protection chain. Speaking to simple things like DNS hijacking, which is a very material risk for someone corrupting a news chain or a live event, and substituting fake news or fake sports or whatever. So that's a much different risk profile from us from an end-to-end standpoint than just, you know, just the pure watermarking problem alone. And the second one is watermarking is we do watermark now per distributor. So we actually will be able to take a feed and say, hey, it's going to this distributor versus this, and do that in real time and actually control the watermarking feeds to track in near real time where that source is being leaked or harvested or prosecuted, if you will, on a token basis.
And what is that?
March Madness.
Oh, thank you. We have like a minute and a half. Anybody have any questions? Anybody? Oh, sorry. March Madness is going to have to wait.
Be able to detect at which points in the migration of an asset that you actually get a vulnerability to the thing.
That's what you just described is typically how the watermarking technology works, applying different signatures throughout the process so that if there's an attack or someone leaks content somewhere in the creation of that content, we can find out where it happened. And we can do it regionally, we can do it by distributor, we can do it by pretty much any mechanism you've come up with to know where it came from. It's popular with specifically with movies, kind of pre-release, but also on video content. Right, that's how throughout the creation process of that content, it's watermarked at different times. Once it's out in the wild, that's a whole different problem.
Any other questions?
Any questions?
So I think we're really looking at a triad right here, three legs of the stool. We've got the prevention. Cybersecurity. We've got content protection, watermarking, but then also we don't want to forget about recovery. This is continuity plans. When live sports is on the air, how do you recover that signal?
Interesting, say that. And what business are you in, sir?
Yes, and of course, at Turner, we're working, we have that all under one roof.
I think that's really important. As Andy mentioned, Andy works on my team, by the way. And I did not plant that question, although I do own $50. I'll say this: Turner's owned by Time Warner, HBO, Warner Brothers. are also part of the Time Warner family. And Turner's the only one that has information security, content security, compliance and business continuity all under one roof. And it really does work nicely together, and the teams really operate. When something new comes out, or an acquisition's made, all those teams kind of work together to try to integrate those capabilities across all the different functions. So I think it works really nicely, and Andy's right, the recovery piece, getting back online, is a key component of incident response. If something bad happens, you've got to get that service back online. And I was in a control room for one of the debates. It was a Republican debate in Miami, and the head of CNN was in the control trailer, and we cut to commercial. There were only two commercials. I think the commercials were like $250,000 a pop for this debate, and the commercials were delayed. We went black for 4 seconds. He couldn't get back fast enough to the engineers to ask him what had happened. I mean, that's an extreme delay in their mind. It feels like an eternity potentially at home. Some people probably didn't even recognize it, but the sensitivity, there were 100 people working on that problem back in Atlanta when that happened, to try to figure out, make sure it didn't happen again. I mean, I was really surprised by that, you know, how important it is to keep that broadcast signal up and running, especially during a live event.
All right, we're out of time. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Great panelists. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you. Give me a round of applause. Fantastic.